Every November, a botanical marvel delights many of us in many parts of the country. It's when the jacarandas come into bloom. They were brought here along with wisteria by Alexander Macleay, a controversial colonial figure whose life was filled with adventure, romance, and a passion for natural history and fauna. Born in Scotland, he was appointed Colonial Secretary in New South Wales in 1826. He was also Australia's first speaker in the colony's Legislative Council of 1843. His other legacies include one of Sydney's finest remaining colonial mansions, Elizabeth Bay House, and also the Macleay Museum at the University of Sydney. Yet I think it's fair to say Alexander Macleay has been a little overlooked by history. Now a new biography, Alexander Macleay from Scotland to Sydney, aims to set that right. Author and historian Dr. Deralee Cherry is behind the project, and she joins me now in the breakfast studio. Deralee, welcome to breakfast.
Thank you, Fran.
I've got a jacaranda tree growing outside my house. I had a beautiful wisteria vine growing over my house in Canberra. I've got a lot to thank Alexander Macleay for.
Yes, that's lovely. And just look at Sydney every October, November, as you say, and it's just filled with jacarandas. And I've often thought if he could come back today and see what Sydney looks like, how thrilled he would be.
Well, tell us about that. How did he come to bring jacaranda and wisteria to our shores?
Yes, well, the jacaranda was sent to him from seed from South America, and he successfully propagated that, and we have all these plants.
In Britain? Here.
It was sent to him in Australia. And, you know, he was a very good plantsman, so he was able to get it growing. And the wisteria is a very interesting story because that was sent to England from China in 1816. And Macleay had a country estate in Surrey, and he grew it there. And he was very lucky to get a big piece of that first plant because he was with the Linnaean Society who were getting all the first plants and all the new discoveries in that exciting new world.
So the wisteria came to England from China. He got a cutting. He promulgated it and he brought it over?
On the ship with him in 1826, plus many other plants to this wonderful country.
And can we safely say that from those seeds and that cutting, the jacarandas, the wisterias that I knew came from?
The wisteria certainly came from there. The jacaranda would have come from that original seed, but yes, and there were other plants. He brought herbs out on that ship as well, such as dill, coriander and cumin. Could you believe it? Those Asiatic plants, herbs in those days. And he also bought grapes. He was very well known for grapes and an interesting plant called the port wine magnolia, which is still a rarity in gardens these days and highly prized.
So he sounds like a broad man with broad level of interest. I mean, I noticed that, you know, he's been called the father of zoology in this country. He's credited with founding the Australian Museum in Sydney. He grew these plants. He brought the grapes for the wine. He's got a vast array of interests.
I think that's what makes him stand out from the rest of many of our early colonial founding fathers, which is how I describe him, because he did have this vast range of interests. But not only that, he was expert in these areas and he helped Australia develop in all these areas.
We were lucky in that sense to get him as a colonial secretary. How did that come to pass?
Well, he had worked in the Transport Board in England for many years, but of course when the Napoleonic Wars ended in 1815, he was out of a job, like many other people, I might add.
He was out of a job for a long time.
He was for 10 years, and he did have a large family, only 17 children, but 10 lived to adulthood. And in 1825, there were six single daughters who were still unmarried, and, you know, he was kind of keen to get them married, and sure enough...
Thought the colonies was the answer.
That's right. But so, not only for that reason.
But what did the British authorities or British government see that he had to offer the colony? Why was he chosen? He was quite old at the time.
Yes, he was, would you believe, 58 when he came to this country, which is extraordinary to think that he came to a new career at the other side of the world. But he was a very highly respected administrator and he'd worked in the public service very efficiently for many years, and he had a lot of people backing him and people in the right places, and he did prove to be a very diligent and experienced administrator.
Though in the end, politics sort of did him in, didn't it?
Well, yes, it sort of did. No, but then, you see, it came in full circle because whilst he was dismissed from Governor Burke, although he got on very well with the first Governor Darling, he became Australia's first Speaker in Legislative Council in 1843. And his previous adversaries, such as William Charles Wentworth, congratulated him on his appointment because there was no other person in the colony with his experience.
This is a long and active life. Becoming a the first Speaker of the New South Wales Parliament at age 76.
Yes, it's extraordinary, isn't it? It really is extraordinary. And, you know, he was getting, you know, he had a few physical limitations by then, but he still managed to perform his duties admirably.
And why was he given the job? I think you say it was a very popular choice, and yet you also say many times in the book that he was sort of ridiculed by Australian society often. How do those two things match
well,
up?
Well, I think the colony was changing. It was coming away from the convict settlement. They were thinking of it as a free settlement. The convict transportation to Sydney ceased in 1840, and, you know, the pastoral activities were burgeoning. And Macleay was involved in all of these things, and he therefore managed to get the support of most of the community by the 1840s, because he was interested in so many things that affected so many people in the community.
So when you say it was a figure of ridicule, why?
that's a very good question. Why are people figures of ridicule these days? But he was an unusual-looking person, there's no doubt about that. There is a picture in the book of him as first speaker in the Legislative Council, would you believe? But he has a shock of white hair, but he looks, you know, quite distinguished. He was a rather short stature and rather stout, but he had a very thick Scottish dialect, apparently, and it wasn't quite like some people would have thought the position of colonial secretary should appear as.
So not a grand stature is what you're saying?
No.
He was a big family man. He had 17 children, 10 grew to adulthood. Clearly his favourite was his daughter Fanny.
Yes.
His daughter Fanny lived at home for a long time. And we know a lot more about Alexander because of the letters, a discovery of letters, Fanny's letters. Can you tell us a bit about that discovery?
Yes, I think this is probably the most exciting aspect of the whole story in some ways. In the 1950s, as recent as that, an historian called Malcolm Ellis was at Camden Park. Of course, that's John MacArthur and Elizabeth MacArthur's house. And they were related to the family through descendants later on from Macleay. And they were having dinner, went down to the cellars for another bottle of wine, saw some big chests in a corner of the cellar that had never been opened. 3 days later, after working through a massive amount of keys, they opened these treasures, these chests, to discover a veritable treasure trove of letters, 600 letters that Fanny had written to her brother over the period 1812 to 1836, which had been locked away for many years.
So this chest had been sitting there for perhaps 100 years.
Probably for 50 years. They would have come from Macleay House in the early 1900s when the material from Elizabeth Bay House was transferred to Camden Park. But certainly for 50 years they would have been sitting there unknown. And the letters are interesting too, because they're in the Mitchell Library today, and they're written on small pieces of paper both ways across the page. So they're very hard to decipher.
And what do the letters tell us? Is a particular gem that you can recall?
Yes, the letters gave us an entirely different perspective on Alexander Macleay, of course, through the rosy-tinted glasses of his daughter.
His favourite daughter.
But she was very smart and very intelligent, and they've given us an entirely different picture of Macleay than has ever been written about by the historians to date. And it's quite extensive material that she writes, lots and lots of details, and they've enabled me to put the biography together in a way which I think truly reflects on Macleay's character.
Now, we should talk about one of his other legacies, Elizabeth Bay House, which really got you going.
Yes.
On Alexander Macleay, because you visited a long time ago and you loved it, and indeed it is stunning.
Yes.
Inside, isn't it?
Yes, that's it. And in fact, how I got interested in Macleay in the first place. I walked into Elizabeth Bay House, saw the beautiful staircase, looked up and saw this dome, which, by the way, is very unique in the world, because most domes in these sorts of houses are round, but this dome is oval, and it really is especially elegant.
It is especially elegant. Well, thank you very much, Deralee, for telling us about Alexander Macleay and, in fact, documenting his contribution, which is significant to Australia. Deralee Cherry and Alexander Macleay is her book, Alexander Macleay from Scotland to Sydney, published by Paradise Publishers.